Sorry, I've got a bit of a sore throat and I'm not a natural public speaker, so... is there any way I could get a bit of light actually going that way? I'd like to introduce, like, say, as Roger said, I'm from South London Radical History Group, and I wanted to say that this kind of speaking to a kind of audience of people sitting over there in seats facing me on the stage is totally anathema to what we do as a group. Normally, we're very much kind of focused on a kind of collective experience, collective understanding of history, and so we set up to examine like our place and our present and where that came from. And normally it's a kind of very much a kind of collective, people go off and learn things. None of us are historians, I'm not a historian at all. I'll probably get something facts wrong in what I say, and people know out there that I'm wrong and can stand up and challenge me or whatever. But basically we wanted to learn about history because we came from an activist background. We wanted to change the world for the better now and create a better future. And understanding of the past we thought was a very important part of that. I was invited to come down here and I wanted to talk about basically black abolitionists in England who were involved in the campaign to end the slave trade. And it kind of focuses on particular events and people in London, and that's kind of part of my research. There may be similar things in Bristol and other places that I don't know about, and I'd be happy to be enlightened about stuff like that. But the stuff that I've learned about is kind of based in London, but it's applicable and it has links to all over the world. There's a received myth of the end of the slave trade, obviously, which people are kind of obviously aware of. This sort of heartening tale of the great and the good, who kind of realised that this was that the slave trade was immoral, and they worked very hard, and in Parliament, and they lobbied Parliament, and it was eventually, after a lot of hard work, the slave trade was abolished, and that was the end of the story, and everything was fine and happy after that. And obviously there are kind of saints and heroes like Wilberforce, Granville Sharp, Thomas Clarkson, who are kind of considered the movers and shakers in this. But I mean, my understanding from what I've read and is resistance to slavery started like almost as soon as slavery started and carried on through the whole period when slavery was being carried out. And the resistance was carried out by the people, of course, at the sharp end, which is the slaves themselves. And that resistance carried on like, right from the beginning to the end of slavery and to the end of the slave trade. And what I'm going to talk about later on is how that actually carried on into political radicalism of black people kind of within London, like after the slave trade had been allegedly been abolished. Other speakers at other meetings, I don't know how many people have been at other meetings, have probably discussed sort of slave revolts, slave rebellions like in the Caribbean, etc. I'm not going to talk about that particularly because I thought other people would have covered that. But I think that, I mean, the crucial thing is that, I mean, the most powerful black abolitionists were the people who physically rebelled against slavery, took up arms, like, and attempted to create autonomous communities in the Maroon Wars. Those are not the people I'm going to talk about, but I think that's a powerful history that that's a real abolitionist movement. But it's also it's worth pointing out, I mean, I guess people are aware of this, is that, I mean, this is the 200th anniversary of the ending of the slave trade. Slavery was not abolished till nearly 30 years later in the Caribbean. Some of the vaunted heroes and saints like Wilberforce, who campaigned long and hard for the ending of the slave trade, refused to campaign against the ending of slavery in the colonies and the empire at the time, and in fact like were resolutely set against the ending of slavery on the grounds that basically slaves, black people, were not capable of running their own affairs, were not capable of handling freedom in any way, and there still needed to be some kind of transition period where they could be, I guess, educated into some sort of better way of behaving or something. This is, of course, not really a surprise for Wilberforce, since, like, politically, apart from his involvement in the abolition of slavery, set his stall out completely against radical reform of any kind in this country, and I was a fervent opponent of reformist movements, parliamentary reform and the radical movements in England, all through the sort of late 18th and early 19th century, when reform was a powerful movement here. I think he not only considered that black people weren't capable of running their own lives, I think he just considered that kind of the poor basically weren't capable of running their own lives. Which is obviously a common feeling at the time. As I said, I'm not a natural speaker. I want to talk a bit about the kind of background, the sort of black community in London, and the kind of background and the sort of that people are coming out of. And there have been sort of significant numbers of like Africans in London for probably since the late 16th century. In late Elizabethan times, there was a kind of small African community in London. Not so small that Queen Elizabeth couldn't get worried about it and tried to introduce a law to throw all black people out of the country, I think in the 1580s. By the 18th century, London had a sizeable black population, which I've seen various estimates of the numbers on. There's one estimate says there were 20,000 black people, which Africans and including sort of some Asians as well, in London. Although other estimates say there was probably 10,000 black people in the whole country, so it's hard to kind of get a handle on what kind of numbers they're talking about. I mean, this is before censuses and at a time when a lot of people were living in areas that the authorities didn't really kind of have an idea what was going on and didn't have any control over. It's true that certainly a lot of black people living in London, because of the lives they'd lived, probably died very young, were subject to disease, poverty, and so the numbers probably fluctuated quite a lot. The vast majority of London's black residents in the late 18th century were ex-slaves or former sailors, or still were working as sailors. A lot of sailors who ended up in London were runaway slaves or freed slaves, had worked their passage from the Caribbean or from Africa in some way, and kind of maybe stayed involved in slavery, stayed involved in sort of shipping. For example, Alardo Aquiano, who we're going to talk about later on. Many others worked as domestic servants. Most black people in London at that time were in a difficult legal position. Even after 1772, when there was a judgment from Lord Mansfield in the High Court, basically, which said that trading in slaves in England was illegal. You couldn't actually bring slaves into London or take them out of England. Although it didn't illegalise slavery, it said you couldn't. There was no law in England which allowed people, slaves, to be transported through England. Even after 1772, people's legal position was very ambivalent. They couldn't legally be deported by their owners, but there was no actual legal protection for them in any way. Work was very much restricted, even before 1731, but in 1731 the Lord Mayor of London introduced a law which banned any black people from being taken on as apprentices, which is at the time basically banned them from getting involved in any trade at all in London. Obviously worried about the sort of growing black population I'm not sure if it's the first known instance of a colour bar in British employment history, but certainly not the last. Other jobs that black people became predominantly involved with were city porters, watermen, people who carried water to houses before piped water was generally available, basket women carrying baskets of food and selling it, hawkers, chairmen, like people who would hire themselves out to carry people from place, like richer people from place to place for a fee. Black women also predominantly worked as servants or nurses, and many were forced to turn to prostitution, especially later in the 18th century. Basically, the poor relief system that existed, such as it was, didn't support most black people who couldn't show they were fixed residents of any particular parish, and so basically people were reduced to extreme poverty and surviving on their wits and begging in any way. Black beggars became very conspicuous in the late 17th century, and even more so in the late 18th century, and many were crowded into areas called rookeries, very poor slum areas, virtually no-go areas for the authorities in many ways, particularly areas called like St Giles or Seven Dials, which is around modern Covent Garden. St Giles is particularly famous for its black population, the so-called St Giles Blackbirds, who were sort of hyped up into this kind of ruthless, cunning criminal fraternity, kind of parasiting on the city or whatever. Robert Wedderburn, who's one of the people we'll talk about later, lived in St Giles for a while in the 70s, 70s and 80s. I mean, the kind of areas that people are often ending up in were areas of general poverty, semi-criminal areas, so-called. There was actually a specific society set up called the Society for the Suppression of Mendicity, which is like a society for controlling and doing away with beggars, which is kind of part charity and part coercion. And they had a whole program of attempting to control black beggars, which involved all sorts of bribery, trying to get them to work, or if all that failed, rounding them up and getting them deported back to the West Indies, which even as late as 1816 still meant deporting them back to effective slavery. Despite being from many countries and backgrounds, though, the slaves built up and divided in so many ways, the sort of London black community, ex-slaves, etc., created a lot of social links, but also organised itself politically. There's kind of two levels to this. There was almost two classes in a way, or two castes. There was people who were servants in sort of respectable households who were kind of maybe educated and semi-literate or literate. And then this kind of like underclass, like who were maybe beggars, kind of part-time workers, etc. And the there's evidence of like the sort of black servants meeting to discuss legal situation and political ramifications for slavery, etc. Dr. Johnson's black servant Francis Barber was said to be holding gatherings of like other servants in Dr. Johnson's kitchen when Dr. Johnson was away, and they were apparently discussing things like the Mansfield judgment. There was also a larger social scene that was very noticeable even in the 1760s, black gatherings in sort of taverns. There's something of black domestics of both sexes were said to have supped, drank and entertained themselves with dancing and music at a public house in Fleet Street in 1764. No whites were allowed to be present. Sort of seems quite enough, really. The community also showed sort of solidarity for its number who were faced with repression by the law. Two black men who were imprisoned in the Bridewell House of Correction, which is a kind of pioneer workhouse type later struck prison. And they were in prison for begging in 1773, and they were supported financially and visited by up to 300 others. According to writer Philip Thickness in 1778, quote, "These black men have clubs to support those who are out of place, i.e. out of work." But it also kind of writes implying support for runaways and ex-slaves who are living undercover or living on the run. A common complaint at the time was that longer established escapees or ex-slaves in London were influencing newer arrivals to escape from their masters. And there's a quote from a bloke called Edward Long who has been called the father of English racism. He developed a lot of ideas about the inferiority of Africans and the superiority of the white race. So I don't know if we should take him as gospel, but this is what he reported. He said, "Upon arriving in London, these servants soon grow acquainted with a knot of blacks, who, having eloped from their respective owners at different times, repose here in ease and indolence, and endeavour to strengthen their party by seducing as many of these strangers into the association as they can work to their purpose." And the Bow Street magistrate, John Fielding, referred to sort of subversive ex-slaves as being intoxicated with liberty. "The sweets of liberty and the conversations with free men and Christians enlarge their minds." And even worse, he reported that they succeeded in allying themselves with the London mob, the sort of rebellious working people of London. Which we know to be true, in that ex-slaves and black, there were several black rioters who were ex-slaves involved in the 1780 Gordon riots, when what initially started as a Protestant backlash against changing the law to make things easier for Catholics, became a general uprising against, of the poor against the rich in London. And two black men named Benjamin Bowsey and John Glover were among the leaders of the attack on Newgate Prison when Newgate Prison was razed to the ground. And Robert Wedderburn, the later black radical, was certainly a witness to the Gordon riots and may have been involved in it. And I can't remember her name, I've written it down and I wrote it on another bit of paper and I've lost it, but one black woman called Charlotte something was one of the people executed after the Gordon riots. Building also linked this sort of subversive feelings among among black people in London to the spirit of slave rebellions in the West Indies, and it sort of implied or suggested connections between fugitives in Britain and those still in chains in the Caribbean. And it is known that there are ex-slave rebels from revolts in Belize and Jamaica who kind of managed to work their way to London and were kind of involved hanging around in the rookeries and in the slums. And the numbers of people in the slums, and certain numbers of black people in London, were swollen by an influx after 1784 of loyal ex-slaves, so-called, who had fought in the American War of Independence, had been basically promised freedom by the British forces in the American War of Independence if they fought against the colonists and the revolutionaries. Many of these were poor when they arrived. By the time they arrived in London, were quite poor and very embittered, as they'd been promised all sorts of things which hadn't materialised, and they'd been uprooted and forced to take refuge in London. Others who ended up in London had certainly been involved in some of the acts precursor to the American Revolution, and some of them had become imbued with some kinds of spirits of ideas about liberty. So there's kind of hodgepodge of ideas and like rebellious and subversive ideas going on in the 1770s and 80s in London. So at least part of this embryonic black community was sharply conscious of legal and social developments relating to slavery. They followed the Mansfield judgment in 1772 in the Somerset case, where James Somerset was going to be deported by his former owner, and Lord Mansfield's ruling was that this was illegal. And certainly black representatives were sent to follow the hearings of the case, to sit in the gallery and follow the hearings. And when the judgment was given, when Lord Mansfield gave the judgment against the traders, they clapped and hugged each other when the judgment was given. And a few days later, there was a victory celebration, a gathering of several hundred black men and women in a Westminster pub, which I think was possibly the kind of better, maybe the servants and kind of people who were better off, since the tickets were £5 to get in, which kind of put it out of a lot of people's kind of access, really. But there was actually powerful support for fugitive slaves among working people, among white working people in London at the time, which didn't come from any kind of sentimental or humanitarianism feelings. I think it basically came from a sense of solidarity that they were facing the same masters, the same rulers, facing the same similar sorts of oppression, not the same. But people saw that these alliances were a matter of class solidarity. The traditions of resistance to the authorities in the London slums, which were often a matter of fighting off press gangs to force people into the army and the navy, fighting off posses setting to seize fugitive criminals or debtors. And these have been long established in the slums, going back 150, 200 years. And these were extended in the 18th century to support runaway slaves and people who were being pursued by their owners. A struggle that was going on at the time in London is that slaves and were black slaves who were still owned and working in London were attempting to force their masters to pay them wages. This is a kind of another kind of complaint of the white kind of upper class commentators of the time, kind of another sign of everything's going to pot and everyone's getting uppity. And the struggle to attain wages, to be paid wages for your work, is a huge step for a slave. And it doesn't only help attain economic independence, i.e. you can save up your own money, maybe buy your freedom, know, maybe have a slightly better life, but it also conferred status. And it conferred, if you had paid a certain amount of wages, it conferred the right of residence within a parish, which could not only prevent you from being deported by an owner, but also maybe like enable you to get poor relief as well later on. So the struggle for wages were actually kind of was a kind of sign of social and political self-confidence, which I think fed into the political organising that around abolition. So this is the kind of environment. I tried to find out more about kind of black resistance. I know from what I've read that there was resistance, that people who owners who attempted to seize former slaves and runaway slaves, or just kind of seize black people on the street and say, right, I'm going to sell you into slavery, were resisted physically by both black and white people. I haven't actually managed to find anything that says it happened on this date, but this is the thing that I've read as being described as happening. I'm sure it's out there. I'd be fascinated to learn more about it, but that's one area that I've looked into that I couldn't find more about. This black community became very threatening for the powers that be in the late 18th century. And I mean, by the end of the 18th century, by the turn of the century, they were actually rounding up black people at random in London and deporting them to Van Diemen's Land, to Australia, Botany Bay, just on the grounds that they were trying to weed out people who were like kind of troublemakers and criminals, etc. There was a growing mass of discharged sailors of all colours, discharged soldiers of all colours around this time anyway, which is becoming a threatening situation within London. So this is the environment, this is the kind of environment that people are operating in. I mean, it is kind of twofold, like a dual nature, a kind of proletarian class in the slums, beggars, ex-sailors, and a kind of more educated level, maybe people who are literate, people who have been taught to read, people who have been servants. We do know more about the people who were involved in the latter, but there was kind of clearly, I think, some kind of crossover between the two, and I'd be interested to know more about that myself. I don't really know much about it. I'd like to talk now just a bit about some of the individuals who were involved, actually physically involved in abolition campaigns. The best known is Olodo Equiano, which we were hoping Ruth was going to talk about. he's famously known for the interesting narrative, which is the story of his life from the time when he was a child, when he was seized, and then when he was seized and sold as a slave. And I mean, I don't know how many people have read it. It's a kind of stunning story, and a kind of conventional story in a way. It's quite interesting. It's shocking in that, like, he's totally uprooted and manages to survive all these ups and downs. Like, he's sold into slavery, he has various masters, he's sold on by the masters, and his masters have a habit of selling him when he shows some kind of independence, or when he kind of shows sort of the likelihood of maybe buying himself out, etc. And he did later gain his freedom, part of the work he was doing when he was a slave, and which he carried on doing after he was free, was working on various ships around the Caribbean and across the Atlantic, and later on in different parts of the world. He actually went to the North Pole at one point, and the ship trying to find the North Passage. And he later settled in London. At an early point in his life, he'd been taught to read by a family that he was staying with, and he became in London. He became involved in the rescue of slaves, which kind of became a turning point in his life. I think he'd certainly become a Christian at an earlier point. He became which this is why I said it was a conventional story, because it's kind of quite a parallel story. This interesting kind of his conversion to Christianity, which is quite a common thread in kind of narratives of the time of people, that kind of how I kind of became to be a Christian. But he in 1774 he attempted to save the ex-slave John Annis, who he'd in fact recruited to be a cook on a ship where he was an agent. and Annas was seized by his former master, and basically Apriano got in touch with the famous abolitionist Granville Sharp, who was specialised in taking cases to protect ex-slaves or runaway slaves who'd been who were under threat of being deported back to the West Indies or being seized by their former owners. And Granville Sharp took Annas's case to court, but the case ended up failing for various reasons, and Annas was actually shipped off to the West Indies and flogged to death, which kind of, I think Acreon describes this as a turning point in his life. An interesting kind of like aside to that is that Equiano had to actually swear a writ of habeas corpus, like to try and get Annas freed, and in order to do it, he had to whiten his face up because he wouldn't have been accepted to swear a writ as a black man. So, as well as publishing his life story, which is republished several times, he was an active abolitionist and actively did a lot of propaganda work. I mean, the interesting narrative has been described as the single most important document in the abolition of the slave trade, because it had a huge effect. It was very much like written from the first person, revealing what was going on inside his head when he's been going through all these processes. And that was very shocking for a lot of people, and it had a huge effect. It was reprinted over and over again several times over the first years when it had been in print. And he also wrote on slavery for various sympathetic papers, did critical reviews of various pro-slavery tracts by slave owners and their apologists. And he also set off around the country on speaking tours, speaking to various groups all around the country. And this had a very powerful effect on people's sort of concentrated people's minds about abolition. This is mid to late 1780s. And it's interesting because he has a kind of pivotal role in radical politics as well, in a way, because he went out and met a lot of people on his speaking tours, sort of people who were getting interested in abolition, but also getting interested in parliamentary reform and radical reform of the society in England. And he actually put a lot of people in touch with each other. He met people in constitutional societies around the country, and then he put a lot of those people in touch with people like the London Correspondence Society, which is an artisan working class radical group in London, which set up in 1792. And he actually kind of served as a link man in a way, for not only a sort of link man to the black community and to the radicals, but also a link man to some more respectable abolitionists as well. He actually joined the London Correspondence Society in 1792. He had a personal influence on a lot of people. He had a personal influence on Granville Sharp, who was a friend of his, and he actually quite affected the work that Sharp did. I mean, he was the person who told Granville Sharp about the Zong incident, where a master of a ship transporting slaves to the Caribbean actually murdered 132 slaves, I think it was, by throwing them overboard. While the ship was en route, on the grounds that they didn't have enough food and water to feed them all, for which there was a prosecution taken, and I think they were found not guilty. But a friend of Equiano's, who was also involved in abolition campaigns at the time, was Cobna Atoba Kuguano, who was originally from Ghana. And he'd been abducted aged 13 and transported to Grenada. But he was slightly more lucky than others in that by the time he was 15, he was actually freed. And he was brought to Britain, and he became a servant in London. He was a servant to a man called Richard Conway. And he got himself baptised, which at the time, if you were baptised as a Christian, there was a general belief that you couldn't be sold as a slave if you were baptised as a Christian. I think this had a kind of dubious legal situation, but it was a very powerfully held belief, and he in fact became a lay preacher. He also became involved in abolitionism. When he and Equiano formed a group called the Sons of Africa, which is a black abolitionist group, and he was involved also in speaking tours around the country. And in 1786, he played a part in the rescue of Henry Germain, who was a black man basically kidnapped and destined to be shipped out by his former owners. And Kigoano actually got Granville Sharp to take up the case and managed to get Domain released. So you've got this, on the one hand, these people are actually doing propaganda, on the other hand, they're actually physically involved in like, attempting to stop people being deported. In 1787, Kigoano wrote, Thoughts and Sentiments on the Evil and Wicked Traffic of the Slavery and Commerce of the Human Species, which is, it was actually written before Equiano's book, and it's probably the earliest written black counterblast against slavery. And the text demolished pro-slavery arguments about the divine sanction of slavery, the justifications for it that Africans also take slaves, and that Africans are only fit to serve, or that slaves are better off being slaves than the European poor who are starving to death. And he systematically demolishes all these arguments which are being used by the slave owners at the time. And the text not only advocated abolition, but sort of disputed sort of emerging racial theories which were being used to justify slavery, dismissing talk of that there was any such thing as separate races. And he talks in terms of the many shades of the rainbow, and that all of us are fellow creatures. And this is kind of a counterblast to racism in a way, ideologically was just emerging. People were starting to theorise, bring up theories for why Africans are being kept in slavery by white people. He also linked slavery to private property, and spoke of a desire to turn the world upside down. And he kind of raises interesting ideas that are kind of before their time in a way. Like not in so many words, but he says, like, he posits the idea of basically slavery is a crime against humanity, which is not a concept that really comes back for like 150 years, and spoke of slaves not only having moral right but also moral duty to resist slavery, which is an interesting perspective. And he taught for the total abolition of slavery, not just the slave trade, which a lot of the abolitionists were working for at the time. And he said that a fleet that should be organised and sent to Africa to suppress the slave trade physically. He did, like Equiano, similar to Equiano, he did assert that there were practical and economic reasons why slavery should be ended, and that it was actually in the interests of like plantation owners to use free labour rather than slaves. This may have been like a practical approach, like a way of appealing to sort of slave owners' like better interests at a time when there were people starting to think in those terms anyway, which is some historians take the view that slavery is actually abolished because it did prove to be more economic to use like free labour, so called. He was kind of using those practical terms, but he also sort of, on the other hand, sort of wrote in quite apocalyptic terms, sort of warning of like of revenge and uprising if the slave trade didn't come to an end. And there's a great quote which I dug out, which is, it's like, history affords us many examples of severe retaliations, revolutions and dreadful overthrows, and of many crying under the heavy yoke and subjection and oppression, seeking for deliverance. Yet, O Africa, yet, poor slaves, the day of thy watchman cometh, and thy visitation draweth nigh. In that day thy walls of deliverance are to be built, in that day shall the decree of slavery be far removed. What revolution the end of that predominant evil of slavery and oppression may produce, whether the wise and considerate will surrender and give it up and make restitution for the injuries that they have already done, as far as they can, or whether the force of their wickedness and their iniquity of their power will lead them on until some universal calamity bursts forth against the abandoned carriers of it on and against the criminal nations in confederacy with them, is not for me to determine. But this must appear evident, that for any man to carry on a traffic in the merchandise of slaves, and to keep them in slavery, or for any nation to oppress, extirpate and destroy others, that these are crimes of the greatest magnitude and the most daring violation of the laws and commandments of the Most High, and which, at last, will be evidenced in the destruction and overthrow of all the transgressors. Which, I kind of like. understates. Clearly there was an organised group around Equiano and Kigoano called the Sons of Africa, which we don't kind of know very much about. Several other black men entirely men, signed Sons of Africa letters and public statements in the late 1780s. I'd actually just like to read their names. It kind of, it's not evidence of anything, but I'd quite like to do it. So, just to remember them, because I don't think they're remembered in any other way, possibly. So these are the people who actually signed Sons of Africa statements, letters to the newspapers in 1787-89. Yane Elani, otherwise known as Joseph Sanders, Ruga Jugendsmel, William Green, George Robert Mandeville, Kojo Ameri, Thomas Cooper, Bernard Elliott Griffiths, Daniel Christopher, John Christopher, James Forster, John Scott, Jorge Dent, Thomas Oxford, James Bailey, James Fraser, Thomas Carlyle, not Thomas Carlyle, the later defender of racism in the 19th century, by the way, William Stevens, Joseph Almazi, John Adams, George Wallace, and Thomas Jones. Obviously, these are using names that have been forced on them by owners or their families who allegedly control their destinies. But it's interesting to just remember in some way that these people kind of stood up. And these Equiano and some of these other people went to Westminster to listen to debates on slavery. And as the abolition movement progressed, they were kind of received slightly better than initially. Also at this time, there's actually a grassroots abolition movement sort of growing up in England, which is kind of parallel to the kind of like more upper class parliamentary abolition movement. This was sort of inspired partly by the speaking tours of abolitionists like Equiano and Cugoano, and partly as well by the obvious links to their own struggles for reform and political change. In 1788, there had been 100 petitions flooding Parliament from all over Britain demanding abolition of the slave trade. And these are mostly not of the result by the great and the good. They reflected a kind of emergence of consciousness of slavery in the working class movement and the reform movement that was at that time sort of emerging. Mass support for abolition was first expressed in Manchester, where it was initiated by two members of the Society for Constitutional Information, which was founded to promote the doctrine of human rights, advocated by Thomas Paine. And the Society was kind of one of the originators of the wave of radical agitation that produced a lot of activity in the 1790s, and actually especially linked up with the French Revolution. The two leaders of the Manchester radicals, Thomas Cooper and Thomas Walker, surprised and delighted Thomas Clarkson, the abolitionist Thomas Clarkson, when he visited Manchester in 1787, by telling him of the spirit which was then beginning to show itself of the people of Manchester and of others on the subject of the slave trade, and which would unquestionably manifest itself further by breaking out into petitions to Parliament for its abolition. And from the start, really, this opposition was central to the radical movement. It was adopted in parallel with their own demands for reform. Major Cartwright, who was a kind of known as the father of reform, who kind of worked for parliamentary reform and within the radical movement for like 60 years, he worked closely with abolitionists like Grant Clarkson and Sharp, and he wrote in 1788 to his wife, "Should the West Indian slaves, who had the other day not the slightest prospect of such an event, but find themselves emancipated, who can say that there is no hope of our constitutional rights and liberties being restored?" And I mean, you can see that people were linking the two issues together in their minds. And in 1790s, when the London Correspondence Society and other radical groups, influenced by the French Revolution and working for their own radical change here, they immediately linked slavery to their own class struggles. And equality between black or white, rich or poor, was initially adopted as part of the central programme of the London Correspondence Society, although it was kind of toned down over the next few years, unfortunately. Olado Equiano actually lodged for 2 years with Thomas Hardy, who was a shoemaker, as the founder of the London Correspondence Society. And he, as I said, he joined the London Correspondence Society, so there's actually like physical like cooperation between these groups. And one of the radical texts of the time were these monster meetings, huge rallies where people would come down to meet and hear speakers talking about reform, often held outdoors or on the moors or somewhere. And like in 1794, in April 1794, when Sheffield Radicals organised their biggest ever mass meeting, attended by thousands of artisan cutlers, and a resolution called for the emancipation of black slaves as well as the ending of the slave trade. The resolution combined sort of abolitionist humanitarianism, radicalism and working class solidarity. Slave merchants and planters were condemned as unfeeling barbarians, and the resolution said, "Wishing to be rid of the weight of oppression under which we groan, we are also induced to compassion for those who groan also. And as no compromise can be made between freedom and tyranny, there should be a total emancipation of the Negro slaves." Now, this radical movement that was emerging was sort of in some ways put on the back foot by other events. There was certainly fear and terror in England, particularly among the ruling class, and certainly also among the abolitionist ruling class, like Wilberforce and his brother. At the news of the 1791 slave revolt in Haiti, and this definitely put the wind up people. It did to some extent cause radicals to kind of slightly backpedal a bit on their kind of demanding emancipation. Which is a shame. To some extent, though, fear, in the writings of some of the parliamentarians at the time, you see fear of the working class and the spreading ideas of liberty, a sort of fear, bound up with a sort of defence of the status quo as far as the slave trade is concerned. But they were indivisible for one lord. I couldn't find his name. He said in 1793 that the idea of abolishing the slave trade is connected with the levelling system of the rights of man. What does the abolition of the slave trade mean, more or less in effect, than liberty and equality? What more or less than the rights of man? And what is liberty and equality, and what the rights of man, but the foolish fundamental principles of this new philosophy? If proofs are wanting, look at the colony of San Domingo, Haiti, and see what the rights of man have done there. It was also argued that in the Lords that the order and subordination, the happiness of the whole habitable globe is threatened by abolition. All being equal, blacks, whites, French and English, wolves and lambs shall all, merry companions every one, promiscuously pig together, engendering a new species, man, as a product of this new philosophy. Remember he's slagging it off there, but it sounds quite good to me. And it's they're kind of warning that if you abolish the slave trade and all sorts of other things will pop out of the box, like the transportation of people, of criminals to Botany Bay, flogging of soldiers, the forced impressment of seamen, the exploitation of factory workers. No, who knows where it'll end. So it was a feature of this new radical movement that it actually disturbed the anti-slavery section of the ruling class as well. Wilberforce's brother-in-law grumbled that respectable folk in Hull connected abolition of the slave trade with democratical principles and therefore would not hear it condoned. And Wilberforce's friends complained of Thomas Clarkson's fellow abolitionist of his enthusiasm for the French Revolution, and Wilberforce asked Lord Munster to caution Clarkson against such talk. It will be ruin to our cause. This kind of leads me on to a figure that I think is one of the most interesting figures of that time, who reflects both the poles of abolitionism and attacks on slavery, and also the radical movement and the development of like of a very extreme radical politics. This fellow called Robert Wedderburn, who to me is an intriguing figure. He, in some ways, Olodo Requiano and Kigoano had sort of appealed in their writings to a lightened self-interest of growing capitalist interests and to moral feelings and humanitarian feelings. And whether or not this sort of reflects their true beliefs or was kind of was used as a practical approach to try and achieve their ends. And Equiano was more than happy to sort of cooperate with the government-sponsored schemes like the scheme to ship ex-slaves to Sierra Leone, to set up a kind of colony in Sierra Leone, and kind of as particularly black, people who'd been forced out of America during the War of Independence, although he was forced out by the administrators of the scheme when he sort of questioned all the jobbery and bribery and kind of inefficiency that was going on within the scheme. Wedderburn, however, was to develop a much more radical view of slavery and how it would be overthrown. And he had no truck with the existing order at all. And he consciously formed links to rebellious slaves in the Caribbean and consciously linked struggles of slaves in the Caribbean to struggles within England. He was the son of Rosanna, who was an African slave, and her master, James Wedderburn, who had Rosanna flogged, and when she was 5 months pregnant with Robert, sold her on, which seems like reasonable behaviour, not. So Robert Wedderburn grew up with his grandmother, sort of disenfranchised from his father's family completely, and this did have a lasting bitterness throughout his life, and did affect the way he viewed the world. His father's family were kind of extremely well off, and he spent his entire life in poverty. So he grew up with his grandmother, who was kind of a powerful influence on his life in Kingston, and his grandmother was called Torquay Amy, and she was a kind of agent for merchants, but also a figure who used to do sort of small-time magic for people, for which she was like flogged at least once by her owner, and she taught him basically how to fend for himself and kind of look after himself in the world. And he sort of carried that through in front for his life, and he kind of sort of, in a way, he was also fascinated with magic and religious ideas and spirituality, and I think he got that from her as well. But when he was a teenager, he joined the Royal Navy, and he served in the Navy for a while and ended up in England in 1778 and in London. He got involved or was a witness to the Gordon riots. He certainly claimed later to have known some of the ringleaders of the attack on Newgate, and it's not really well known. But later on, in about 1786, he converted to Methodism and became a Methodist preacher. And so Methodism at this time, was a kind of mixed bag, really. Methodists did take a position against slavery very early on, and worked very hard against slavery. It did also have a whole ethic of working hard, like not questioning society, not questioning the natural order, and you know your place, and your salvation is only religious and only personal through the Lord. But Methodism also led a lot of people who passed through Methodism went on to develop very powerful social ideas as well. And it also served to trade, because it had this idea of people being lay preachers, and religion wasn't something that you have a professional class of clerics, but religion is something that comes from people, it comes from within, comes from your own relationship to God. It did encourage people to become preachers on their own account, and I think this did train people to speak up and in public speaking, but also in thinking for themselves and kind of becoming public figures. So a lot of people who went through Methodism come out the other side and become interested in other kind of radical ideas and politics. And Wedderburn became a preacher. He remained a preacher for many years. But later on, certainly in the 1790s, he seems to have gone back to sea. He may have been forced into the Navy again, or he may have joined up. He was living in poverty at this time. He lived in St. Giles, in the rookery of St. Giles, which I mentioned earlier, which is an area where a lot of very poor black people were ending up. And he was living in extreme poverty, although he had acquired a trade by then. And his name comes up in connection with the 1797 mutiny at the Nore, which is a mutiny within the Navy over conditions. And the rebels are said to have links to the Jacobins, the kind of radicals in London at the time. And although his name is not mentioned in any official account, there's a picture, an engraving of the committee of the Nore sailors, the kind of the elected committee like meeting, and there's like one black figure at the table, and one writer, Ian McCalman, did speculate that this might have been a representation of Wedderburn, but we shall never know. Later on, in the early 19th century, Wedderburn became a friend and ally of Thomas Spence, Now, Spence was a Newcastle teacher who became one of the sort of leading ultra-radicals in the 1790s. And he sort of developed a set of ideas as to how society could be turned back into an equitable society, based mainly around the control of land, like seizing control of land, and that control of the land by everybody was like a crucial part of his programme. And this is at a time when enclosure had basically driven like the vast majority of English people off the land, and the process was sort of starting to happen in other countries. And that, so control of the land is very central to his ideas. And Spence is a very interesting individual, and he had a lot of influence on Wedderburn. Spence wrote a lot, kind of mixing religious ideas and political radicalism. And he was very much a millenarian in the sense of he believed that a millennium was coming when the existing order would be overthrown, and that a new society that would be brought in that was like fair and free and equal, and everyone would be free. There'd be no masses. Earthly authority would be overthrown. And one idea that Wedderburn held very strongly, that he partly got from Spence and partly from black slave traditions as well, was the idea of the Jubilee, which was originally a biblical idea that basically in the Bible the Jubilee is said to be an event that is held every 50 years that restores lands to its original owners, cancelled all debts, freed all slaves and bond servants, and it was also a year of no work, only a year. The idea of Jubilee kind of is said to represent an idea of a more egalitarian time of where the Jews in the Middle East sort of living in harmony before like hierarchies were set. But this idea was kind of taken up from the Bible and used throughout history several times. It was used by the early Quakers, including Bristol's favourite James Naylor. Also the Diggers, and it's kept alive in the writings of Milton, Bunyan, and the utopian writer Harrington. And Spence kind of took up the idea of the Jubilee. It was at the kind of heart of his plan for seizing back the land, which is one of the original principles of the Jubilee, and that this Jubilee would come and everything would be like returned to the natural order. And the natural order was the kind of primitive communism that we all lived under before hierarchy and before class society had arisen. Spence was also the main figure who actually kept alive throughout the kind of years of the Napoleonic Wars and the years of repression of the sort of radical movements in England. He kept alive the idea of black and white equality and unity, and he wrote constantly through that time about international issues. And he wrote a lot about slave revolts. He wrote about Native American communities and Caribbean communities in the Caribbean, and like kind of autonomous and social developments that they were developing were kind of, and sort of drawing them into his ideas. But it's interesting. It's also interesting that Jubilee had also been a feature of slave mythology as well, and they'd also taken like in subversive readings of the Bible, they'd taken this idea of Jubilee as the time is coming, we will be free, and it kind of was developed in kind of underground slave ideology really as a kind of to justify the desires for freedom, to justify the use of force in ending slavery. And the idea of Jubilee can be seen recurring in the heart of slave rebellions that take place in the 18th century. Wedderburn's Jubilee was a kind of fusion of Spence's Jubilee and the slave theory of Jubilee. And it's kind of most famously brought out in a paper that he did only a couple of issues of in 1817. Which is called The Axe Laid to the Root, or A Fatal Blow to Oppressors, being an address to the planters and negroes of the island of Jamaica. Now this was published in London. He'd been living in London for 30 years at this time. And in some ways this was just one part of a huge circulation of ideas, underground papers, rumour, sort of ideas that were being passed via sailors, ex-slaves, that were going to and from like London and England and the Caribbean. And the Axe Laid to the Root recalls the flight of the Hebrew slaves. It builds on the early egalitarian of the early Christian church, and also draws on the positive examples of the Maroon Wars and slave revolts to sort of build up an idea of how a change might come and how, look, the justification for overthrowing existing society. Wedderburn saw history as a kind of international process, basically, of expropriation of the land and expropriation of people into enslaved terms, and a resistance to that process. And he drew on traditions and talked about all sorts of traditions going back, like black and white traditions, going back to the Peasants' Revolt and the English Revolution, and also sort of traditions of organising within slave communities, and binds them together. And he says basically that God gave the earth to the children of men, allowing no difference to the colour or character. And you can see the influence of Thomas Spence in that he sees the land as crucial, control of the land as crucial to any possibility of a successful slave revolt. And he advises, in the Acts later, he advises slaves or successful slave rebels to seize lands and hold on to them. That's the key to victory. Interestingly, he also advocated that if a successful slave revolt should institute universal suffrage, including suffrage for women, which most radicals in England weren't advocating at the time, but excluding whites and anyone with over £500 property. This is kind of total world turned upside down to the kind of current systems. Yeah. He's still from his Methodist kind of background, he still has a very powerful reliance on biblical texts, which is in the radical scene at that time, that was a very powerful tradition. A lot of people still saw radical politics and even, you know, revolution, overthrow of society in terms of biblical texts and justify it from biblical texts. And he kind of links it also into other social questions and went far beyond kind of the abolition movement, went far beyond even kind of earlier black abolitionists. He links slavery as an institution to the existence of prisons, which he advocated should all be opened up. He looked forward to a communism of common ownership of the land, as well as back to kind of like history to base his ideas. And as well as justifying slaves arming to rebel, justifying their right to rise up, he also not only advocated English workers arming, like to overthrow the oppression in their own lives. He was very much involved in the radical scene, post-Napoleonic War radical scene, when there was a kind of groundswell of popular anger against the government, and pressure for reform, but also a kind of submerged pressure from the sort of dispossessed as well, which did threaten revolution to some extent. There was lots of riots. There was a lot of people meeting clandestinely to plan uprisings. Wedderburn was at the heart of this process. He was actively involved. He took part in clandestine drilling with other radicals during these sort of crises of 1819 to 20. They forged pikes and put pikes onto pike heads, and they used to drill, like preparing for uprising on the open spaces in central London and West London. He also ran a subversive chapel in Soho, and ran sort of, which basically held two public meetings a week for quite a while. And this was kind of political meetings and also blasphemous meetings. He developed a kind of blasphemous religiousness in a way, which I can't really explain in any other way. He was kind of still believed in a God, but kind of he was like this writing examples of his like writings and speeches, and he's kind of just like kind of littered with blasphemy and swearing. Some people used to come to his meetings and leave just because they just couldn't handle his language. So he was very much involved not only in advocating and in contact with like rebel slaves. I mean, the Acts Later route was circulated within the West Indies like clandestinely. It was actually hunted down. There were huge rewards for copies of it if they were seized. Like, in fact, slaves who handed in a copy could be rewarded with their freedom, allegedly. And he had a correspondence with his half sister Elizabeth Campbell, who was white, and she freed her own slaves under his influence. But she was actually persecuted, and her manumissions of slaves were actually revoked by the Jamaican judiciary, basically, on the grounds that she wasn't of sound mind if she freed her slaves. And even figures like Wilberforce recognised Wedderburn's powerful influence. When Wedderburn was in jail in 1820, Wilberforce visited him and suggested that he write his life story, which he later put down as a book called The Horrors of Slavery. To me, he's a figure kind of that takes the kind of movement against slavery further and takes it to its logical conclusion in that the whole world needs to be turned upside down, the whole of the existing order needs to be turned upside down, and this kind of jubilee or millennium is coming where not only slavery but wage labour will be overthrown and we'll all live free and happy, which we're still waiting for. Another figure who was associated with Wedderburn, who was a friend of his, who took this even further at a similar time, was a man called, another Jamaican called William Davidson, known as Black Davidson, who was a contemporary of Wedderburn. He was born in Jamaica, another son of a slave woman. He had a checkered career, which again involved being pressed into service as a seaman, and he set himself up as a cabinet maker. He was quite a literate individual, very strongly influenced by Thomas Paine's Rights of Man. And he joined a group called the Marylebone Union Reading Society, which is in northwest London, Marylebone. And they held meetings in his home, and they had a banner featured a black flag with a skull and crossbones. And the motto, "Let us die like men, not be sold like slaves." And Davidson, in 1819, Davidson had been around the radical movement for a while, and as I said, in the 18 and 19 to 20, there was a huge crisis. There'd been like a huge sort of pressure for reform, and like the government had repressed it with lots of repressive measures taken against sort of the disenfranchised, which culminated in the Peterloo massacre, where a meeting for reform was attacked by the yeomanry in Manchester. About 11 unarmed demonstrators were killed. Up to 500 were injured, and this created a huge, I mean this kind of was a spark that ought to have set off sort of a huge uprising, really. And there was a kind of huge plans all around the country for an uprising. All these groups were drilling in secret all around the country, and Davidson joined the group of Arthur Thistlewood, who was one of the leading ultra radicals in London, and they were basically plotting an attack on the cabinet, which was to be the general signal for an armed uprising around the country. And they, the whole group had been permeated from the first by a police spy called Edwards, who formed most of the plots and encouraged them into desperate acts, and they then betrayed them to the authorities, and they were all arrested. And Davidson, along with Thistlewood and others, were tried for what was known. This was known as the Cato Street Conspiracy. They had actually planned to blow up the entire cabinet at a dinner, but although he maintained in his trial, he wasn't involved in any plot. He was quite clearly implicated. I mean, he took part in robberies of rich passers-by in St John's Wood to raise funds to build for gathering weapons, and he's seen in meetings that were meeting representatives of groups in other cities who were planning an uprising. And so, I mean, because of his colour, he was like vilified in the press even more than the others. And several members of this conspiracy were found guilty, and five were executed, including Davidson. He was hanged and executed on the 1st of May 1820. Which seems another good reason to commemorate the 1st of May. But, Davidson, Davidson and Wedderburn lead on to some other figures who come up later in the 19th century, figures like William Coffey, who was one of the leaders of the London Chartists, who was a black tailor, who was eventually transported for uprising in 1848 after the failure of the last Great Chartist petition. And he was transported to Tasmania for the rest of his life. And I think throughout the early 19th century, very much a consciousness that black people in London were very radical. They were involved in things like the Spar Fields Riot of 1816. They were involved in these conspiracies. They were involved in sort of like Coffey, who was also involved in Taylor's strikes. They were very much kind of involved in what was going on. And obviously the press picks up on this, and they call the Chartist the black man and his party, to kind of try and do them down with that. That's kind of the end of what I was going to say, really. I mean, I haven't really got a kind of fast and hard conclusion to it. I started off by investigating people that I found interesting. I kind of found Wedderburn endlessly fascinating and would like to know more about him. But it's clear that the kind of idea that slavery was kind of abolished by the great and the good on behalf of black people is kind of rubbish. And that figures like this were working under the surface, not only in terms of revolt and rebellion, but in terms of campaigning and propaganda, and constantly raising awareness, making links, forcing the pressure upwards. And I think, as any understanding of history to me, is that people create history, working people create history, and that seems in this case that abolition was not something that was descended from above, like, but was pushed upwards from below. So that's it.